This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is a big week for the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine. Today, the FDA deemed it safe and effective, and it appears to be more effective than originally reported against these newer, more infectious variants, which brings the vaccine a critical step closer to being authorized for emergency use. Here's Governor Charlie Baker at a press conference this morning.
On the same day to have Johnson & Johnson's vaccine deemed safe and effective by the FDA, and to have Moderna and Pfizer say they would double their vaccine production in March over the level of vaccine production they did in February, is a really positive development in so many ways.
Now, Johnson & Johnson says it could have 20 million units of its single-dose vaccine available by the end of March. Dr. Dan Baruch is the director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. His lab helped design the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Dr. Baruch, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So how good are you feeling today?
Today's a really good day. We're very excited about the new updated data released by J&J this morning, as well as the FDA review, independent review of the data that deemed the data set to show safety and efficacy.
We talked about this efficacy against the new variants when you were on the show at the beginning of the month, and you just referenced the new data. Were you surprised that there were numbers that came out that showed the vaccine to be even more effective against those variants than earlier thought?
Well, what we have now is a larger data set because there are more infections now in the study than there were a month ago. So this represents the data up to date as of now. And with a larger data set, then we see improved efficacy against the resistant variants, the so-called B1351 variant that originated in South Africa, as well as the P1 and P2 variants from Brazil.
So did that surprise you?
I was very pleasantly surprised, but I think it's very important, not only because those are areas of the world that we need to protect, but also those variants are also circulating in the United States as we speak.
You talked about the fact that basically as you get more numbers, right, you get more information. Does that mean, because obviously case numbers unfortunately are going to continue to grow, does that mean those numbers could change more either for better or for worse over time?
Well, the data set is large now, and the study has reached its primary endpoint. There will be, of course, continued follow-up in the clinical trials. So there could be updates of the data, but I think that the data set today is a very robust data set, and it will be reviewed by the FDA External Committee on Friday. If FDA approves the vaccine, then it will be rolled out starting potentially as soon as next week, and it would then be the third vaccine rolled out in the United States.
Okay, I have to go back and ask you then again. That's a vaccine for the coronavirus. This is a public health crisis of 100 years proportion. How does it feel to have dedicated your talents to help creating something that could be on the market helping people next week?
It's an amazing feeling. It's truly surreal. We've worked on this vaccine essentially every day over the past year. And we're delighted that it appears like it's reaching fruition. And what's most important now is the vaccine, if it's approved, to be rolled out and to start saving lives. I haven't quite had too much time to reflect on it. There will be time for that in the future. But right now, there's a job to do. And we hope that the vaccine can be deployed and start saving lives as quickly as possible.
So I want to ask you a bit of a complex question. We know that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in testing had a lower overall efficacy rate than Moderna and Pfizer, but it was 100% effective against hospitalization and death in trials. And Moderna and Pfizer weren't tested against the new variants, and Johnson & Johnson is a single dose. All of that is to say, obviously, everybody wants as many doses of as many vaccines out there as we can get. How do you tell people to think about the differences between the vaccines, especially when they may not have a choice in which vaccine they receive?
The most important thing to realize is that all of these vaccines are very safe and very effective. And so what we need now is we need to accelerate the vaccine rollout. Currently, we're in an era of vaccine scarcity. There's simply not enough vials of vaccine to immunize everyone in our country today, let alone the world. And so the most important feature about the J&J vaccine is that it's going to be another vaccine with a large manufacturer to increase the vaccine supply and increase the pace of the vaccine rollout. I think that the fine differences amongst the different vaccines are difficult to ascertain because the vaccines were not tested head-to-head, and particularly the trials now involve a large fraction of either more contagious or resistant viral variants. So overall, I would say that the most important thing for people to realize is that all of these vaccines are very safe and very effective. And the most important thing is to get vaccinated.
And on that note, that is Dr. Dan Baruch, the director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. His lab helped design the J&J vaccine. Dr. Baruch, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you. So WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg was listening to that conversation. Carrie joins us now. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So let's just start by getting your reactions to what you just heard from Dr. Baruch.
I feel like putting together what I heard from Dr. Baruch and from Governor Baker, there's a whole lot of vaccine coming down the pike, and that is really good news. And in particular, this, you know, very likely third vaccine looking like it's just around the corner. It's one that offers excellent protection, and it has major advantages like being easier to store. It works with only a single dose. And I would underscore what Dr. Baruch said, which is that, you know, people talk about vaccine shopping. And I would say the public health advice is very clear, which is that all of these vaccines that have been approved are great. Just get any vaccine that you can.
So I hear a tone of optimism there. Help us get our heads around how big an impact it would have to have this third vaccine, single dose, maybe as many as 20 million doses available at the end of next month if it's approved for emergency use. How big a deal is that?
Well, I mean, we need multiple vaccines, right? No single source can give us enough. And the way I think about it is that basically this is what the federal government has been predicting for a while, which is that there would be enough vaccines for the general population to get the shots in spring going into summer. But, you know, with this pandemic, you never know about predictions. And so I'd say, like, right now, it's looking even likelier that that will really come to pass and that just about everybody who wants to get vaccinated will be able to in the coming weeks and months.
So Governor Baker talked about this in a press conference this morning about the arrival of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and we heard at the top, hopefully increased supply from the federal government on the other vaccines. He said, quote, we might end up with enough vaccine to actually service the capacity we already have in place, end quote. But this federal supply question, put it in perspective. How much is it the rate limiting factor? If we had all the vaccine we needed right now, could we in fact get it into people's arms effectively?
Well, I think the federal supplies are a rate-limiting factor. I mean, they're not the only one, but they're a huge one. Like Governor Baker said today that the state has demand for about 450,000 doses a week, and it's only getting about 130,000 doses. So that's a big gap, and it could truly make a significant difference if the state gets more vaccines, as it now seems is promised. And as for whether we could get the vaccine into everybody's arms effectively right now, I mean, we're in the midst of a phase that includes a million people, right? So no, not in a day or a week, but this phase is expected to last through April at least, and we're watching the capacity to administer the vaccines ramp up, including today with the opening of the Natick Mall site. Like, I keep thinking it's like World War II when French farmhouses turned into strategic objects. You know, there would be soldiers fighting from the farmhouses. And suddenly our malls are turning into strategic objects in our war against the virus.
It really is something. All right. So I know you know the Baker administration is being called to testify in front of a new legislative oversight committee on Beacon Hill tomorrow. What do you think that's going to accomplish? Will it help?
Well, I certainly think it will be cathartic for a lot of people who are really mad about the technical snafus of the vaccine website rollout. It'll be you know, really gratifying to see lawmakers ask some tough questions of the Baker administration. And also, I'm really hoping we'll get some answers to questions that are really mystifying. Like the biggest one many people are asking is, how can it be that a state that is so smart and high tech could do so poorly with its vaccination signups, at least initially, and especially with that user interface, which I swear it seemed to have been designed by the devil. It was very sadistic. And I'm hearing that people are still having quite a bit of trouble with specific sign-up sites like Walgreens. So I think it will be a great chance just to ask burning questions that are not yet fully answered.
Okay, so that's all vaccine stuff. We spent a year tracking cases, infection rates, deaths, all still critical metrics. What's the headline over the last few weeks there?
Well, the headline, mostly it's a heartening, dramatic drop in cases and deaths. But a Harvard epidemiologist put it very nicely earlier this week. This is Bill Hannage on Morning Edition.
It's certainly premature to think that we are out of the woods. We're not out of the woods. We're just in a somewhat less densely woody part of the woods.
Which is a better part of the woods to be in, right? But we're not out. And Tiziana, there's some more good news just out today about the state's nursing homes. The Massachusetts Senior Care Association says residents and staff have gotten more than 125,000 vaccine doses. And compared to last May, the daily infection rate is down 94% and daily deaths are down 87%. So we're seeing much lower rates in the settings that have been by far the places where there were the most deaths. So it's really good.
So, Carrie, I want to jump to a more meta question here, which is about the disparities laid bare by this pandemic, both in terms of vulnerability to the virus, now in vaccine availability and distribution. You know, we've had discussions around those disparities. They continue to gain volume and steam. Are we making, you're a healthcare reporter, you've been doing this a long time, are we making any of the changes in our healthcare system that are going to be necessary to reduce those disparities going forward?
Well, it's such a big question, Tiziana. I mean, certainly it's been heartening to see how much of a focus there's been on disparities. And I have to say, the problem clearly isn't just in our healthcare system. It's in how people live and work much more broadly. And the pandemic brought those disparities to the fore as never before. And I'd also just add that by far the biggest disparity of all in illness and death was in long-term care. And the state was already taking measures to bolster nursing homes, but we'll see whether the fact that something like 1 in 7 residents there died in this pandemic will bring on more change. That's something I'll really be watching.
All right, before we let you go, you have been such a friend mm-hmm. to Radio Boston over the years, especially this past year. And our listeners probably don't know you're leaving us at the end of this week to become the Boston mm-hmm. Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. So this is my last chance to ask you, what is going through your mind 1 year into this?
1 year into this. Well, Tiziana, I'd like to just take a moment to gloat. It's maybe hard to believe at this moment, but I would like to gloat about how right I was to become a health and science reporter 20 years ago. You know, back then, it seemed to me that progress in science, including biomedical science, was just the most important news in the world, because it so fundamentally changes the human condition when you, say, figure out the structure of DNA or you map the human genome. And that was why I wanted to cover it. And now it's looking like we're seeing science basically save the world, you have to say, with these vaccines. It's science that goes back decades and really centuries. And so for all the sorrow and the ugliness we've seen in this pandemic, I also see it as highlighting sort of the fundamental nobility of the mission of science to figure out the secrets of nature for the betterment of humankind. So I just want to say at this moment, see, I told you so. I was right to become a health and science reporter.
That's inspiring. All right, we have a little less than a minute left. Anything else you want to reflect on?
Yeah, I just want to say one more thing. You know, Beth Tytel in the Boston Globe recently had a great story about how much we lose when we work remotely and we don't get to see our work friends like you. And over the past few days, as word has spread that I'm leaving WBUR, I felt just this outpouring of what I can only describe as love, as sort of collegial love. It's this special love between people who work together. And we don't necessarily hang out together, but when we work together, we admire each other and we're comrades and we're teammates. And lately I've been struck by how truly that is a form of actual love, a beautiful kind of fellowship love that we don't tend to talk about very much, but it so enriches our lives. And I'll miss you. I'll miss all of the Radio Boston team. I love you guys.
Carrie, I love you. Thank you for everything. I'll miss you too. That is Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg.
Thank you, TCR.
All right. One thing we've learned about the coronavirus is that often it exacerbates what already hurts, whether that's at the individual level or the systems level. And one area of struggle that the isolation of social distancing, the stress of economic hardship makes worse are some psychiatric illnesses. For instance, drug overdoses nationwide up 23% last year, highest number of such fatalities ever recorded in a single year. And calls to the National Eating Disorders Association hotline were up 80% toward the end of 2020. Stuart Komen is president and CEO of Walden Behavioral Healthcare in Waltham, which provides individuals living with eating disorders and other psychiatric conditions a safe place to receive support. Stuart, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
So we are in an awareness a week around eating disorders. Let's start there. What is the state of care for folks who are suffering with eating disorders during this pandemic?
Well, the state of care is that the care is good, but there is an overwhelming demand for care at this moment. So being able to get care to everybody who's looking for it is very difficult right now. And you find that not only in eating disorders, but throughout mental health issues.
So when you say overwhelming demand, is that, you know, order of magnitude twice as many people as before? I mean, how big has this impact been from the pandemic?
Huge. We've been looking at our own data. It's 100% increase year over year in terms of demand for service. And every month, from the beginning of the pandemic and through January and probably through February, has been more than the previous month. So the tidal wave has not stopped, and we don't see an end to it anytime soon.
So obviously that hurts to hear. Why? What is happening for people that's driving this increase?
Well, sheltering in place, the whole issue around social isolation, it just creates an amazing, perfect storm. The disease thrives on isolation, thrives on secrecy. So many people have had to put their life on hold. They're cut off from their primary coping mechanisms. There's an abundance of time spent online. All of these things really contribute to the worsening of an eating disorder. We not only see worsening of eating disorders of people who obviously had a disorder prior to the pandemic, but many first-time cases, people who have developed it during the pandemic. So. And all ages, all genders, and all socioeconomic groups, just clear across the continuum of the population.
So, Stuart, what resources are available to folks, especially understanding in the back of our minds that there's this added worry about being exposed to COVID-19 if seeking care?
Well, the one good thing that we have been able to realize it really as a result of the pandemic is the explosion of services delivered online, virtual treatment. And this was something that was not well supported by the insurance companies prior to the pandemic. But when the pandemic hit, many of us providers have moved to a virtual platform. At Walden, we're doing all of our outpatient services on Zoom, and that has had a very good effect. There is some difference of opinion as to whether not having the immediate contact is a good thing, but we found in our data that more people have access to treatment. and that satisfaction with treatment is about the same. So so that's been a good thing, and there are more services available online.
So before we let you go, let's just talk about sort of the narratives of this pandemic. We joke a lot about the COVID-19, people putting on pounds. We talk about all the baking we're doing and all the cooking and eating we're doing.
Right.
Put that in context for us to be sensitive and thoughtful to people who might be experiencing eating disorders.
Yeah,
what do we need to understand?
The discussion around how much weight we're gaining is just kerosene on the fire. That is exactly the kind of thing that a person who is struggling with an eating disorder, who's got the voice in the head that's telling them, you know, you're out of control, or you need to not eat that thing, or you need to work out harder, or whatever it is. The more they hear that, the worse it gets. So that clearly is not something that, and it's all over the place, of course. Because for people without eating disorders, food is a comfort. But for people with eating disorders, they really, respond negatively to those kinds of messages.
So, Stuart, in a sentence, what's the first thing someone should do if they want to try to support a loved one who may be experiencing an eating disorder?
The first thing they should do is really talk to them generally about how they're doing, what's going on in their life, not really related to food per se, but to how they're feeling about themselves or the change in their status. We have many young people. It's really hit the young adult population very hard. They've had to put off college. They've had to put off seeking jobs. Just what being unmoored from what they were expecting that they would be doing now, what that causes and what that creates in their minds about what their life is going to look like. I would say stay away from the food and speak to how you doing, how do we help you with your self-esteem during this period of time?
And that's Stuart Coleman, President and CEO of Walden Behavioral Care in Waltham. Stuart, thanks.
Welcome.
We've been having a series of conversations this month here on the show about what it's like to live and work in our communities if you're Black. Last week, we spoke with three Black professionals about their experiences in the private sector. Earlier this week, we revisited a conversation about Black fatherhood. Today, we are joined by three professionals whose work is focused on public service. Here with us is Monique Symes, who teaches 6th and 7th grade English at the John W. McCormick Middle School in Dorchester. Also, Andrea Perry, the executive director of Youth Connect, which is a program of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston in partnership with the Boston Police Department. And Jerry Cohen, a second-generation driver with the MBTA, a member of the Carmen's Union, and a lifelong Boston resident. Monique, Andrea, Jerry, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Monique, I'll start with you, and I appreciate all three of you joining us to talk about your experiences. Monique, feel free to interpret this however you like. What does it mean to you to be Black in Boston?
Starting off with an easy question, I see. I think when I think about this question, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today very much, so thank you for having me. When I think about this question, I think about it in a couple different ways. I think whenever it comes to anything that has to do with identity, it does, to me, include transition and change. And so I cannot answer this question without reflecting and sharing a little bit about my past. Growing up in Boston, being a family of immigrants from Jamaica, attending primarily white schools, and not really having lots of ideas of what it meant to be a person of color in the city until I went out of the city a little bit of ways to the Berkshires to attend college and then came back. And now as a public school teacher, I have a different perspective as well. And so in short, I would answer, being Black in Boston to me means activism. It means using my voice to share about things that are happening, things that I see, and also helping the young people that I work with every single day to try to make sense of what's happening around them, because that's my best way of teaching. I think of teaching in terms of coaching, right? I learn as much from my young people as they do from me, and teaching and learning is really an exchange. And so my identity has really transitioned throughout my life. And although I've primarily only lived in Boston, I can say that, you know, I feel a lot more secure in my identity as a Black woman in the city that I grew up in and lived in. And I hope that I can encourage my young people to kind of feel that same pride and confidence as they continue to grow up.
Andrea, does that resonate with you? Does that characterize the way you'd answer the question? What else would you say?
I would echo a lot of what Monique shared, but I also, especially in terms of transitions, I think about it in terms of I'm not born and raised in the city. I came to the city in the mid-90s, and I've been here ever since. But when I came in my 20s, I was in a much different place in my life than I am right now. And so I think about those transitions from being an early professional to now being a parent, and thinking about what it means to be a Black female leader in the nonprofit sector. What does it mean to the young people we work with at Youth Connect? What does it mean to now raise a child here in the city who was born and raised? And what does that mean for her to be a young Black girl? And what do I want for her now and in the future is kind of how I think about it.
Jerry, what about you?
I agree with a lot of that. Also, like growing up, I played basketball, traveling around these states, and a lot of people didn't think there were Black people in Boston. So like going around and telling them from Boston, it kind of like, they were kind of shocked, like, oh, there's Black people there. So it kind of gave me a sense of pride being Black from Boston.
So the three of you all went into professions that are of service to others. Did any of you experience surprises or barriers as a teacher, a social worker, a tea driver, as you tried to enter your professions?
Well, I can start. My experience in graduate school was definitely, you know, was predominantly white female. And that was even when I think about
this is social work school.
In social work school, yeah. And even when I think about it now, it is predominantly white female. And so I think the schools in the area have done a better job of trying to have more people of color, have more people who identify as male in the classroom, but it's still predominantly white female. And so I was very fortunate in that my advisor at school was a Black person. And then my field supervisors were Black people, and my first supervisor when I got a job, a real job, was a person of color as well. And so that was something that was important for me, to seek out those mentors and to seek out those professionals who understood what it was like to kind of navigate the space professionally. And so I felt really fortunate, and so I know I try to think about that for my staff right now at Youth Connect, and then also any chance I can talk to a person of color, a Black woman, a Black male, about going into social work or any kind of helping profession, and kind of even how to navigate grad school. It's something I had to figure out on my own. I want them to know about scholarships and opportunities and the different types of support you can get on the campus to kind of navigate and be successful in that journey.
Monique, was mentoring, the kind of mentoring and role modeling that Andrea just talked about, available to you? And if so, was it important to you as you sought to become a teacher and entered your profession?
Absolutely. As soon as Andrea spoke, I was like, that was exactly, you know, a huge part of the beginning. Unlike many young people, I always wanted to be a teacher. I was 11. I wanted to teach. I was 12. I wanted to teach. I coming from a family of amazing women who were just all about service. My mom was a nurse, grandmother nurse, auntie, you know, all the people in my life did things all the time for other people in service of others. And, you know, I saw that firsthand every day. And so I always knew I wanted to work with young people, and seeing, you know, the role modeling just in my family was by far the biggest and most powerful impact on my trajectory and my professional life. And then, you know, definitely echoing Andrea in the beginning, I had and was very fortunate enough to have, you know, female Black role models from a very young age. I went to, you know, the Mattapan elementary school, the Mattahunt, where I can distinctly remember meeting the first woman of color and my first male teacher of color, Mr. Mack, who is now our political director at the Boston Teachers Union, and being like, oh my God, like, this is great, because I had my introduction to schooling in the United States was at a primarily white school. I was in Metco. I was bused out to Lexington, and I felt very odd, you know, to put it very simply. And so having the representation is really, really amazing. We, you know, as a Boston Public Schools, and in conjunction with our BTU, we hosted a series of events for the first week of February to kick off and participate in the Black Lives Matter at Schools Week. And our young people, you know, from 3 to 4 different schools around the city of Boston really echoed that having someone in the classroom that not only looks like them, but can share and talk about the challenges that they too have gone through, and to help navigate, you know, kind of, you know, really piggybacking off of what Andrea said, because it's not just about, oh, I see you in that space and I see you doing that thing that I may want to do. It's being able to be in communication and conversation and community with people. And just just representation alone is not enough. And so I would definitely say that I was fortunate enough to have that representation and have that role modeling, and still do. And I share that, you know, with my experience with my students every day.
So, Jerry, we know you had at least one role model because you're a second generation driver. So I think it was your father who was also a driver for the MBTA. What did you expect as a Black man when you decided to sort of stay in the family business? And is that what happened?
That wasn't the original plan. It kind of just happened. But my dad supported us. He raised 6 kids, and so it was a good paying job for him to raise us and support for us. So that's kind of the way I went with it. So I know it was stable. It's a stable job. So
Please finish your thought, Jerry.
No, it's fine. Growing up, I just knew, like, I can take that route and, like, be successful in a way.
And how long have you been a driver?
6 years.
Has there been anyone who's sort of taken you under their wing or helped show you the ropes or made you feel supported or welcomed in the job?
Well, being a second generation driver, I kind of knew a lot of people already. So my dad kind of, like, prepped me, I guess, for the job. So, and also we worked in the kitchen at Charlestown Garage. So I know a lot of people from cooking up there. So I wouldn't say anyone really took me under their wing, but my dad did, I guess you can say, because he pretty much told me how everything was going to go. And I kind of knew from firsthand just being around the job.
So I'll ask the three of you, and any of you should feel welcome to answer. We're going through a huge racial reckoning in the country now. We tend to mark it with the Minneapolis police killing George Floyd last summer, but obviously we have been in a struggle for centuries. In this last year, as our country has developed a collective awareness of our systemic racism, has anything in your work gotten either easier or harder that you would want to talk about? Monique, maybe you could start if there's anything there for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I'll start by saying, you know, I've been teaching going on 10, 11 years now. I started teaching directly out of college at about 23 years old. And what I would understand as the young me, right? Like before the last 10, 11 years, I would say teachers don't talk about race until something happens. And I only talk about, you know, race issues or things that are tough and challenging if I'm studying them. And now that was my understanding. And then somewhere along the line, and I can't really place it, but somewhere along the line, even with my Black teachers, and I, you know, I can say this with a lot of confidence because I have reflected and I've, you know, kept in touch with a lot of my educators. I also got this message from my Black educators as well, where it's like, you talk about this, you know, this meaning race, if it's in relation to what you're already administering and sharing with your young people, but you don't really go out of your way to make it a thing. And I had that message prior to my teaching. And I say that to say I completely flipped the switch probably about 7 years ago, because it did take a couple of years for me, in all honesty, even though I work in a school that, you know, we service young people who are primarily of color and identify mostly about 40, 45% of my student population identifies as Latinx students, with another large portion identifying as African-American, and then smaller portions identifying as Asian, white, and other. And I say this because it took me a while to even feel like it was okay to share myself authentically as an adult educator. I didn't feel that I could share, you know, conversations and books that were focused on race pretty easily, unless I could point to a standard that I was hitting, or unless I got approval from, you know, someone who was, you know, observing me, that I could read or do this thing. And that felt really, really disheartening. And this happened more than once. And then there was this switch where it was, now you need to talk about it. And so I say that to say that it has been really, really damaging, especially as a woman of color, as a Black woman and an educator, to kind of always be on the side of not really about truth telling, because like I mentioned before, I consider what I do creating the space so we can, myself and my students can engage in meaningful dialogue. But it really has been disheartening to just kind of, you know, be in that mind space of, I want to provide a space for my students to engage with real world things. And then having at one point being told that it's not important enough because we don't think that's what they need to know. And now there's a shift of, this is what we need to talk about all the time. And there seems to be a lot of and more pressure to not do it authentically. And that's what I have a problem with. And so, you know, it's been very pleasant, I will say, in the midst of all that. But I am a little bit wary that what the messaging is that if you don't engage in this, then you're not you're not doing what quote unquote needs to be done. Because I do believe, just like we, you know, we tell our students, like, show up as who you are, and you cannot force, you know, people to have conversations that they're not ready to have. And that includes adults, just like it includes young people. And so I just wanted to just share that as both a challenge and both a pleasant experience that I have been able to be in more dialogue and community spaces with my colleagues and my young students around race. But yeah.
So I'm sorry to cut you off. It's just, I want to make sure we've got time to hear a little bit from Andrea and Jerry on this. We've got about a minute left. Andrea, anything that's become easier or harder?
Well, definitely harder, and personally and professionally. You know, our at Youth Connect, our proximity to the police department, you know, as social workers who work inside BPD, definitely just made our hearts even heavier. You know, we are working with young people who are encountering the police every day. And then to watch the murder of George Floyd and to have kind of help staff personally and professionally kind of try to make sense of something that does not make sense and shouldn't make sense just adds to the weight of just already being a social worker and working with the young people we work with at Youth Connect. And then personally, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and so we are having conversations, and to see part of her spirit, I feel like, not shine as brightly is just hard as a parent to sit there and watch it. Hearing Monique talk as a teacher in the Boston Public Schools makes me a little bit more hopeful and hoping that my child gets to have conversations and safe spaces like that, like Monique is creating, gives me a little bit of hope. But it's definitely been a hard year.
I'm sorry, Jerry. Any last thought from you?
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of tension. I would say when these events have occurred with operators like whether you're white, black, or whatever. And you can just tell, like, things are different now. Like, there's definitely a lot more tension in the lobbies. Like, if something's on the news, whether people are agreeing or disagreeing, it's just very different now. Like, if people speak up more, and they might not like what you say, but I feel like these conversations need to be held.
Well, I appreciate the three of you joining us for the conversation today. Jerry Cohen, Andrea Perry, Monique Symes. Thank you to all three of you. It was generous.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Finally today, we're going to revisit a trip that Radio Boston's Paris Alston took to Martha's Vineyard. As Paris puts it, growing up, she and her family knew of Martha's Vineyard as the Black Hamptons, a place where the Obamas, Oprah, other prominent Black people vacationed. She tells us more about her connection to the island.
I grew up in North Carolina, a long way from Martha's Vineyard. And before I came here, what I knew about the island is that it was a haven for African Americans. I'd seen Jaws, but the movies that really struck home for me were Charles Burnett's The Wedding and Mattie Rich's The Inkwell.
Are you trying to break my door down?
You call me?
I did?
Yeah.
Maybe I did. It doesn't matter now. You're here, right? So what do you want to do?
Do?
What do you want to do, Drew?
I don't know. What do we want to do?
Is that your bike?
Yeah, that's my bike. Yeah, that's my bike.
I want to ride your bike. I want to ride your bike downtown to the arcade.
To the arcade?
But I want to drive your bike.
You want to ride my bike?
Yes.
To you, that might seem like a simple moment between an awkward teenage boy and his crush. But for me, it was amazing to see movies in which Black families were spending leisurely time at their summer vacation homes, riding bikes, hanging out at the beach, playing tennis, being carefree. And something magical always seemed to happen while they were there. Those movies were based off the town of Oak Bluffs, a place that holds special significance for African Americans. In the late 1800s, Martha's Vineyard attracted freed slaves and laborers. As they began to settle there, they faced racial discrimination and segregation. Oak Bluffs was one of the few places where African Americans were allowed to buy property on the vineyard up until the 1960s. As time went on, it emerged as an enclave for Black property owners. Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. talked about the town in A Place of Our Own, a documentary film by Stanley Nelson, which details the African-American experience on Martha's Vineyard.
It's great to be able to associate with people who share your interests, the educational background, to put it bluntly, your class interests. That is what is unique about Oak Bluffs, that Black people doing well is the default. You know, that is the norm. That is the bottom line, the baseline. We should be proud of that.
Professor Gates is getting at an important piece of the vineyard's history, that it was a place where Black people could be themselves, own property, and relax while on vacation, and where that wasn't a surprise. So I decided to go on my own exploration of the vineyard, and especially Oak Bluffs, which is on the island's northern side. Today, it's a place where many Black people have homes that have been passed down through their families for generations. Harriet Smith is one of those people. She grew up in Chicago, but back in the 1940s, her grandmother bought a cottage right by the Inkwell. That's the beach where Blacks have always been known to hang out on the vineyard. Some say its nickname comes from the Black artists and writers who occupied the space. Others say it came from white vineyarders offensively describing what the beach looked like when it was crowded with Black vacationers. Smith remembers coming to the vineyard as a little girl. Now she shares that tradition with her children and grandchildren.
Every year when school was out, we got in the car and drove 3 days to get to here and spent the entire summer because my grandmother was able to have this property. So that's a summer home for us. We've always had it. It's had it that long. And, of course, my children grew up here, you know, in the summers, and it just became a part of who we are.
The vineyard has a reputation of being a place for affluent Black Americans who can afford summer abodes that can cost anywhere from $2,500 to $20,000 a week to rent, let alone owning them. But as Gabrielle Abelard told me, the island is a place where African Americans don't have to explain themselves.
It's not something that we're used to, especially in Boston. You know, we're all professionals here, and it's something that you don't run into. Like, people are used to seeing successful Black people here.
I spoke with Elaine Weintraub, who co-founded the island's African-American Heritage Trail alongside Carrie Tankard in 1989. Weintraub says the trail tells a story of people who refused to accept the limitations white society imposed on them.
Five generations ago, when those properties were acquired, that was a tremendous achievement against a time in U.S. history when that was not an easy thing to do. For those people, those shoulders that the fifth generation are now standing on. These were heroes. These were people who achieved against all the odds, and I think that's the story. That's what makes the vineyard different.
While on the vineyard, Paris went on a driving tour of the island's African-American Heritage Trail with leader Joanne Joseph.
So she started doing this little boxing skits.
Along the way, she learned about Black homeowners like teacher, dancer, and boxer Emma Maitland, writer Dorothy West, and others. Afterward, Paris sat down with Joseph to learn more about how leading the tours has made her a steward of Martha's Vineyard's Black history. Joseph began by talking about the Scherer Cottage, which was the first inn on the island that welcomed African Americans as other places refused them.
The first time I went there, I had goosebumps because I did the tour a couple of times with Elaine, and I couldn't believe that this had been here the whole time I had lived here, and I knew nothing about it. So I decided that I'm going to study, and I'm gonna put on the best tour ever. I'm gonna, you know, just make it relaxed enough so that people are absorbing what has happened here, because so much has happened here. The way that I had of looking at the world was, it was different because I'm from Haiti and we have a different culture coming here. So I'm like, I have my own history, so I'm good and secure. But doing the trail made me realize how important this is, how important to talk about the history of Martha's Vineyard and how important it is to talk about the history of Edgartown, for example. I did not know that Edgartown was an abolitionist town, had Frederick Douglass speak here in 1857. That's important history that all Black people that come here should know, because our ancestors have been here and have lived here comfortably. When I first came here, I have some friends, and they're Caucasian and Portuguese, but they made sure they told me the history of the Inkwell. And they also told me how this was just African-American Mecca back in the 90s. They would have like amazing parties, and there were these big stars, basketball stars, movie stars that were here on Martha's Vineyard. So I knew about that aspect. I did not know that there were slaves in Chilmark. So that was a bit of a shocker, you know. The other part of doing the tour is that after you've taken people out, it's almost like they get this wind on their back, and, you know, their chest puff out a little bit more. You know, I think a lot of people feel that way after they learn the history of the vineyard. It's just like a villain of pride and happiness. So it's like when you tell people about the cottagers, they're like, oh my God, the group of 100 African-American women who own property on the vineyard. I mean, there's great pride in that.
That was Joanne Joseph, tour leader for the African-American Heritage Trail of Martha's Vineyard. She spoke with Radio Boston's Paris Alston on the island in 2019. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.